And good afternoon. It's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is on vacation. Well, for many of us, Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden is a favorite destination in South Florida. Today, we'll learn more about a major figure in the history of our region, David Fairchild. What's less known is his importance in American agriculture and science in the first half of the 20th century. Joining us in our studios is Dr. David W. Lee. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Biological Sciences at Florida International University and the editor of a new anthology of the life and writings of David Fairchild, The World as Garden. And welcome, and thank you for joining us, David.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Also in our studios with us, we welcome Helene Pancoast. She was a key participant in the production of this book. She co-founded the Bakehouse Art Complex and the Design District. And Helene is the granddaughter of David and Marion Fairchild. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So, Helene, let's begin with you. If you wouldn't mind, what was it like growing up as the granddaughter of
Wonderful.
David Fairchild and Alexander Graham Bell?
Well, I didn't know Alexander Graham Bell, but I certainly knew David Fairchild.
So tell us.
And I spent weekends there because we lived not far away, mm-hmm. and we were allowed to go after we were six, walk over ourselves, and be at the campong, and we spent the whole weekend there.
And what was the campong like at that time?
Pretty well planted with little small things.
Yeah.
There was a pool there, and there were mango trees that were fruiting. And we just had a wonderful time. Gammy just turned us loose.
Now, was he living here full-time, or was he traveling back and forth to the north during that time?
Mostly, they were living in Coconut Grove during the winter, and then in the summer months, they went up to Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, where they had a house that was given to them by their father.
Okay, and David, thanks for joining us. Let's begin with David Fairchild's first visit to Miami in the winter of 1898. So he says he believes there were about 1,000 people in the neighborhood of the Miami River, including Julia Tuttle and Mary Brickell. And what attracted him to the area that Henry Flagler said would never amount to anything?
Well, he was attracted by the subtropical climate and the nearness to the water, which made it possible to grow all kinds of tropical plants. And he had, just before 1898, when he first visited Miami, he had spent quite a bit of time in the tropics, particularly in Java. And so his connection to Southeast Asia then led to later on to his naming of the property they purchased in the Grove as the Kampong.
Which means?
A small village in the Malay language.
Okay. And when he arrived here, you say he was attracted to the region for the climate. What about the heat, the humidity, the mosquitoes? Did that put him off at all?
I don't think it put it off very much.
Helene?
No, it didn't put him off.
Okay, so are there any, tell us about his establishment of this Office of Foreign Seed and Plants Introduction of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Well, the whole process started when he met Barbara Lathrop, who became a patron to his collecting of plants from throughout the world. And it led to an idea to have a central place within the USDA for the collecting of plants for all kinds of agriculture. And so he came back from traveling with Barbara Lathrop and started to work again for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And he wrote the description of what this office should be, what it should be, its purpose. He wrote a very long, well-researched document. And then he basically was given the job that he wrote up.
Oh, okay.
So in 1898, he became the head of what was then called the Section on Foreign Plant and Seed Introduction in the Bureau of Plant Industry of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And what were his responsibilities? What did he write should be the responsibilities of that position?
Well, the responsibility was to go throughout the world to find plants that had commercial or aesthetic value that could be used in horticulture or could be new crops or the improvement of existing crops in American agriculture, and then bring those things back so that they could actually be put into the ground in trial gardens, which were also established in his office, to see whether they would live in different climates and how they would perform, and then eventually to be used in breeding or as a actual crop themselves after trial.
So where were the main places he traveled? And Helene, did you ever travel with him on any of his excursions?
No.
Okay.
No.
Where were his main travels?
Well, initially, he traveled for the first several years after the beginning of the section with Barbara Lathrop throughout the world. And they spent quite a bit of time in Southeast Asia, which was really his favorite place in the tropics, I think, but also Africa and South America, and brought back really many, many hundreds of specimens of plants that could be planted back in the United States. And then after that, he really hired really amazing individuals that went out, explorers, one of the most famous of which was Hank Meyer, who went throughout the world to collect these plants. Many of them worked in China, which turned out, the temperate areas of China turned out to be an excellent place for the introduction of really valuable plants for American agriculture.
If you'd like to join in the conversation, we're speaking with Dr. David W. Lee. He's Professor Emeritus at Florida International University, or Helene Pankost, who was a key participant in the production of the book. If you'd like to speak with either of them about David Fairchild, you're welcome to join us at 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Please join us, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Now, Helene, can you tell us anything about the early history of Miami as you saw it from the Kampong, or from just being the granddaughter of David Fairchild?
Well, I'm not quite that old, but
No. I mean, no, I understand that.
But it was a very different place until what happened in Cuba certainly changed the whole look of Miami and a whole energy of Miami.
Explain that.
It was a pretty laid back place, and a lot of Southerners, and when the Latins came in, it suddenly became a place that was full of exciting things going on. So it was a big change. Coconut Grove is probably one of the few places that's remained pretty much the same. And Coral Gables is another one. But every place else has really changed a lot. And it's good. It's time it happened.
Right.
But you can't walk around in the streets the way you used to be able to. You have to be careful.
Yeah, I guess it's a little different. And now you were married to Lester Pankost,
yes,
who
that's correct.
Was an artist and architect. What, and I know his father, Russell Pankost, was also an architect. Tell us about some of their greatest accomplishments, because they contributed a lot to the city of Miami, both of them.
Well, Lester grew up on Miami Beach. His father's family came early to the beach and grew avocados and limes over there, as well as coconuts. So he kind of grew up on the beach, and I grew up in the Grove. But Russell Pankost did the surf club. He did a lot of houses over there because he was only one of two architects at the time. And he practiced until about 2 years before he died. Built a big firm. And Lester, as a young architect, decided he wasn't going to go to New York after all. He was going to stay here. So he did a lot of buildings for Miami-Dade Community College. He did the police headquarters in the city of Miami, and what was to be the central offices for the city of Miami, but they decided they liked Dinner Key rather than a new building, so that he didn't do that one. But he did a lot of building, and he was very active in civic activities. He was on the board of Fairchild Garden, as was I. And involved in Coconut Grove issues and city issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we were trained as activists, and we continued to do that. I worked with Elizabeth Virick back when she was doing slum clearance. So, but that's another whole story.
That's another story.
Another story.
But didn't Russell do a lot on Lincoln Road as well?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he did the basic layout of that part of Miami Beach. Because that's what he did. And his family owned a lot of the property, so he had more fun because he could do what he wanted to do.
Right.
But he did Lincoln Road, and he did a lot of the streets in the beach area, particularly in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Until it changed.
Until it changed.
Yes.
And David, you say that David Fairchild was the patron saint of the foodie movement, and certainly well ahead of his time. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, as a person bringing back potentially new agricultural crops to the United States, many of these were new food crops that had within their countries of origin a whole culture, how to process, how to spice up, how to make something taste really delicious. And so not only did he bring back the plants, but he brought back the information that he'd gathered by working with the people that were growing the plants in all of these different countries. And his agents did the same thing. So his task was not just to introduce the plant, but was to show people the ways in which these plants could be introduced to American society and to enrich in our cuisine. And it was a very, very difficult process.
Helene, you were going to add something? Did he cook?
No.
No, I didn't.
No, but as the grandchildren, we were always subjected to it first. Anything that came in that was new in the way of fruits. I mean, I faced the first ackee there and the first whatever came in. Some of them were pretty horrible, frankly. But for my grandfather, everything was terrific. So it was fun. It was fun doing it. And it just gave me the heads up on some of the most interesting stuff he was bringing in.
Right.
Helene told me that if the kids did not like the stuff, he'd say, just put a little sugar on it.
That's right. sugar and cream.
Oh, okay. That makes anything taste good.
So right. There's actually, in the book, there's an essay he wrote for Atlantic Monthly when he was retired in the 40s. And it's a pretty well-written description of what he had to go through to try and get people to try new foods. He, for instance, brought a beautiful mango fresh from his grove in Miami up to Washington, D.C. for the Secretary of Agriculture to taste. Mm-hmm. And he refused to eat it.
Ah.
He was a meat and potatoes kind of guy. And so that was the resistance he fought, and he would say largely unsuccessfully.
Look what he was missing. Look what
But I think that it really did. He did make a difference. And so I think he's the patron saint of the foodie movement. That's what I say.
That's great. We're speaking with Dr. David Lee. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Biological Sciences at FIU. And he's the editor of The World as Garden, The Life and Writings of David Fairchild. We're also with, in the studio, Helene Pencoast, who contributed to the book, co-founded the Bakehouse Art Complex, and we need to take a short break, and we'll come back and take some calls and emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here, Joseph Cooper on vacation, and we're talking about David Fairchild with Dr. David Lee, Professor Emeritus at the Florida International University. He's also a specialist in the biology of tropical plants and was director of the Kampong, David Fairchild's old home in Coconut Grove. We're going to talk more about that. We're also speaking with Helene Pencoast, who was a big participant in the production of this book and co-founded the Bakehouse Art Complex in the Design District. That was a major catalyst for the development of the art scene in that area. Before we take our calls and emails, let's talk about the most famous thing that most of us know is Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. Now, how did that come to be, and what was his relationship with Colonel Robert Montgomery?
Well, they were good friends. In fact, both couples were very close friends. It turns out that Nell Montgomery had known Marion Fairchild for a very long time when Nell worked in Coconut Grove at her mother's tea shop.
Nell was his wife.
Montgomery's wife.
Yes.
So there was a friendship there, but Montgomery, who was a very wealthy tax accountant from the North, came down to Florida. He started out in North Florida, but then he soon moved to the southern, south of Miami proper, and he decided that it would be great to have a public garden, to exhibit the magnificent tropical plants. He was particularly interested in palms. And also cycads, and he had had a big arboretum built in Connecticut of conifers. So it was his idea, but he also felt in order for the garden to have a name for itself, that it needed to have someone behind it that was really famous, that could give it instant recognition, and that was David Fairchild.
So he named it after him.
He named it after him. David was an informal participant in the garden. Mm-hmm. He never was president of the garden or director, but he went out and collected plants. He wrote in their papers and eventually in the bulletin when it got started. And he was an honorary president emeritus, although he'd never been president of the garden, but he was definitely the spirit behind the garden as it got started and grew.
Helene, you want to add something about Fairchild?
Well, garden? Both my grandmother and my grandfather, they both were involved in things going on there, mm-hmm. but they felt that it had to develop as its own structure and being, and they didn't want to put too much impetus on how and what they should do, other than try to grow things that couldn't grow anywhere else.
How was that affected? How were a lot of those old trees and palms affected by Hurricane Andrew?
Badly. Yeah, there was a huge loss.
Yeah.
And but the chairman, or no, the director at the time, made good use of that because he had a company come in and saw up the trees into lumber, which they then sold. So they created money to go ahead and put in new material. And that was a crucial, important thing that director did at that time. I don't remember who it was. It doesn't matter, anyway.
Okay.
I was actually teaching my tropical botany course at the garden after the hurricane started. And so the laboratory for that course, for the first half of the course, was just to spend Saturdays cleaning up the garden.
Yeah.
And then if there was a teachable moment like a plant that was being ripped apart, mm-hmm. I could talk to him about the plant and where it came from and so forth. But we all worked there for 8 weeks or so, and then after that we started having more normal labs.
Were there a lot of species that were lost completely from the storm?
Oh, there were species that were lost, but it was amazing how quickly the garden came back. I thought it was going to take many, many years, mm-hmm. and I remember Don Evans, who was the superintendent, said, 2 or 3 years, it'll start looking pretty good, and he was right. It recovered very quickly.
And we have an emailer. Peter wants to know how the collaboration with Chihuly came about. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard that Carol Damian, who's the director of the Frost Art Museum and a art history professor at FIU, approached the garden with this idea, and that they sort of looked into it, and I don't know the details of the negotiation, but I know that Chihuly is coming back again this coming fall.
Oh, that's good.
With a whole new suite of material to install in the garden. So, but I think that Carol Damian was very important in that process early on.
Let's take a caller, Jeray in Miami. You're on Topical Currents. Welcome.
Hi, it's so good to be on. My question is, I guess like in the early part of the 20th century, as Miami started growing in population, and what were David Fairchild's feelings and his opinions about development and construction in the Grove and in the city, and just, I guess, as the city grew westward also?
Helene, do you want to take that first, or David?
Well, I think he felt it was inevitable. But mm-hmm. A lot of us didn't like a lot of what was going on. But that's true of anybody who's lived in any place for any length of time.
Right.
Any change is always kind of not looked at very well. But I'll tell you this, that the consumption and the spread of the love of tropical fruits made a big jump when we got a whole Latin population begin coming in, because they knew what those things were.
Right.
And they could show other people how to use them.
I'd like to add also that David wrote a lot about the experience of children in nature and the loss of green spaces within communities, and it really troubled him a lot. And I think mm-hmm. that he actually became more sensitized by that by seeing his grandchildren grow up and seeing them at the campong. And so he wrote a lot about modern civilization and the destruction of green places,
right.
The need to plant more trees. That was a consistent strain throughout his life, particularly when he was retired. He wrote about it more philosophically.
What were, Jeray, did you want to ask more?
No, I think that's it. I think they covered it pretty well. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for calling.
There is an essay in the book where David writes specifically about that.
Okay. And the book is The World as Garden, The Life and Writings of David Fairchild. And did you take that? Of course, you took that name after his book, The World Was My Garden?
Yeah, I was sort of, it's connected to it. And it's probably not the only thing that has that name, but it seemed like it should be about gardens. So The World as Garden was just seemed to be a natural title.
Right. I was going to ask you what other, because you said Fairchild really was his least, was that he was least connected to that. What other garden institutions was he directly responsible for South Florida?
There are four, what I call garden institutions in Miami, where there's a long tradition, there may be research associated with it, and staying power. And Fairchild Garden, of course, is one. But the second one, the one that he had the most connection to, really, because it came out of his work, is the Chapman Field, which is the U.S. Department of Agriculture Research Station, which is on South Old Cutler Road. And that is a plant introduction station for tropical plants. And he actually was the leader in the establishment of that site in 1923 from an old Air Force station, or Naval Air Force Station, I think it was.
And then I was talking to Linda before, and she told me he did all these plantings just around Coconut Grove, like from Kampong all the way to Cocoa Plum.
Probably the neighbors did that.
Or he gave seeds.
That's right. Yeah. He was always giving out seeds or plant seedlings, and he supplied Fairchild Garden with seedlings, which they used during the ramble, or they would give them away. They had a special thing where they were giving away new plants. And those got out in a hurry.
I think that started probably as early as 1898 when the Plant Introduction Garden was established under his direction as the new director on Brickell Avenue.
And
so those plants could occasionally go out to people or to nurseries to be propagated for landscape material throughout South Florida.
What was his relationship with Mary Brickell, and how he had a lab there on Brickell Avenue? Mm-hmm. And what tell us about that.
Well, Mary Brickell provided the land. Mm-hmm. It was on Brickell Avenue. It was just adjacent. In fact, they cut their 6-acre garden out of the northern end of the Brickell hammock, which he valued. He loved that hammock. Yeah. And so that was where the garden was for quite a while. It was really filled up, and later on it moved to North Miami for a period of time before then it was moved again to its present location. But this plant introduction garden has been in Miami since 1898.
Yeah. Did he worry about the impact of Melaleuca? Was that around, and other invasive species?
It was a big controversy in his professional career. There was a lot of xenophobia about exotic plants because of the cultural connection that plants had to the people and so forth. But he was concerned about it. In his original treatise on plant introduction, he wrote quite a bit about the danger of invasiveness of plants. And he had some personal experience with invasive plants, particularly kudzu vine in his garden in Washington, D.C. So he was sensitive to it. And I would say that given the tens of thousands of plants that were, I mean, really, there's 500,000 accessions now in the USDA database that go back to this tradition, that there have been some examples of invasive plants that came through, but it's a really small number.
This was actually, Albert is running, it says, David Fairchild's time seems very optimistic and hopeful with its arms open to the riches of the world's plants. Nowadays, progressives worry about exotic invasive plants, and the focus on native planting seems to be vaguely the racist attempt to fend off immigrant plants. What changed, and who was right, the Fairchilds or the nativists?
I don't think anyone's right in this, and it's still an issue. Mm-hmm. And I know that when I go to certain meetings, that there are the native people and the exotics, and they like to argue with each other. They may not be necessarily be enemies, but they like to argue about it. And so it's still an issue. There's definitely a place for exotics in our landscapes. There's a great place for natives, and we need to plant more natives. There's lots of natives that we don't plant that are really interesting, beautiful plants that we need to push.
Such as?
Oh, there's lots of little understory shrubs.
Native palms.
Native palms also.
Other native trees. Invasives have always been there because they came in with the water when they have hurricanes and it flooded.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a lot of things planted by hurricanes. I mean, coconuts were not endemic to Miami, but they came in on both on Miami Beach and on Key Biscayne. And, you know, Mathis and Hammock area, so that's where a lot of things came in and got started.
I think right now that we have a state committee that surveys invasiveness in plants, and so it's pretty well surveyed, and there's lots of concern about it, and I think that's good, and so now we're in a pretty good place about having plants that are not native in our landscapes to be very careful about them.
Right.
To make sure they're not invasive.
The attempt to dry out the Everglades didn't help, because when a friend of Granddaddy's, who shall be nameless, but everybody knows who it is, went up in an airplane and spread Melaleuca seeds all through areas of the Everglades, which took off, it was partly due to the fact that they were draining the Everglades and making a whole different atmosphere for plants to grow in.
What was David Fairchild's importance to the establishment of the Everglades National Park?
He was very important. When they first came to live permanently in Miami, he became the president of the Everglades National Park Association. Was there for a short time. I think so that was the time when the committee came down to Miami, a national committee of very important people, to look seriously at the possibility of the park being established. And so he was involved in that. But his biggest role, I think, was that he was a scientist, and he was able to connect scientists, get them to do research in the Everglades. He wrote the scientific treatise, that was very important in the campaign early on to get people to serious about the park. And you have to understand that parks up to that time had been scenic reserves. They were beautiful. They were spectacular. Mountains. So on and so forth. This was the first park that was established that did not have those traditional scenic values.
Mm-hmm.
Its value was biodiversity. And his essay was the first to really make that point. It was the first park that was established for reasons of biodiversity.
Wow. Well, I wish we had longer. I want to ask about the Bakehouse Art Complex and about Director of Kampong, which you were, David Lee. So I'll just encourage everybody. Dr. David W. Lee, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Biological Sciences at FIU and an author. And his latest work is an edited The World as Garden, The Life and Writings of David Fairchild. And he was also the director of Kampong, David Fairchild's old home in Coconut Grove. And we also were with Helene Pencoast, who was a key participant in the production of this book, and the granddaughter of David Fairchild. We want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks
Our
for
pleasure.
Having
My
us.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And the book, again, we'll have a link to it, is The World as Garden, The Life and Writings of David Fairchild. Food and Dining is next.
Illegal dumping is a serious crime that can harm the environment and make neighborhoods look bad. If you witness illegal dumping, you can report it by calling 911 or online at miamidade.gov, then clicking Report Problem and selecting Illegal Dumping.
South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Arsht Center, Gable Stage, Slow Burn Theater, Pembroke Pines Topa, and Ballet Palm Beach. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I present the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, singer-songwriters, and folk music. Plus, guests in the studio. This week, Baker visits us, plus a phone interview with Becca Stevens. The Public Storyteller with Dr. Karen Neal is at 4 o'clock. Folk and Acoustic Music Sunday, starting at 2.
And welcome back to Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper's on vacation. Today we consider sustainable versus organic farming with author, syndicated columnist, Cordon Bleu chef, and our friend, Linda Gassenheimer. Good afternoon, Linda. Welcome.
Hello, Bonnie.
Which is better?
You're asking me? We've got experts to tell us.
All right.
Okay. So sustainable, organic. You know, we hear a lot about both. What do they really mean? Are they interchangeable? Well, here to give us perspective is John Hilliard. He's the co-owner of Hilliard Bruce Winemakers in California. He uses certified sustainable principles in his vineyard. Welcome, John Hilliard.
Hi.
Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Also with us is Marty Mesh. He's the executive director of Florida Organic Growers. He's going to give us the certified organic perspective. Welcome, Marty Mesh.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Join in. Do you have any questions for our experts? The number, it's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Do we have email today?
radio@WLRN.org.
Okay, and the phones are open now. Excuse me. Also, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner Minutes columns, but he also gives the wine. He also has his wine column in today's Miami Herald. Fred, what are we drinking today?
Well, first, I have lots of questions about this sustainable versus organic, but then I'm also going to talk about what wine to serve at an Easter brunch.
All right. Easter's coming up. Okay, let's start with sustainable farming, John Hilliard. You started out using organic practices in your vineyards. What happened? Why did you change to sustainable?
We started out for the first 3 years farming organically because we had a brand new site, and we thought that was the best way to go. And I'm a big fan of the fact that we're talking about both sustainable farming and organic farming, because we're talking about taking care of the earth, and we're talking about people trying to do the right thing. And that's really a wonderful, wonderful thing that we're up to right now. I really liked the, I moved from organic to certified, and I never was certified under the organic program, by the way. We were preparing that.
So you were doing sort of organic style.
In order to be certified.
And to be certified, and then you decided to go to sustainable. What happened?
Yes, well, a lot of things. You know, when you're farming grapes, and grapes are kind of a unique crop. So, you know, a lot of the things that we would be using in our organic program required reapplication every 7 days. And when we look at using the products that we can use as a sustainable farmer, we might not have to re-enter the vineyard for 21 days.
So let me just ask you, the products you're talking about, the organic products you're talking about, fertilizers or pesticides, organic ones, you felt you were using them very often, whereas the sustainable ones, you were not. But what kind of sustainable product did you use that was acceptable?
Well, there are a lot of reduced, you know, risk pesticides that you can use. And, you know, by the way, you know, we as organic farmers and as certified sustainable farmers, we all use pesticides. We're all using chemicals in our vineyards. You know, as everything, as you know, in the world is a chemical. From our chemistry class in college, we learned that. So we're all using pesticides. It's just what type of pesticides are we using? So, you know, for example, I use the environmental impact quotient to judge what pesticides I'm using. So when I look at insecticidal soap, that's got an environmental impact of 19. Horticulture oils would be 27. Pyrethrums would be 39. Sulfur would be 45. A Bordeaux mixture would be 67. The higher, the worse.
Right. But so are those organic pesticides?
Those are typical things that we would be using in a vineyard. And remember, vineyard farming is different from other farmers. It's kind of a special crop.
What I'm asking is that, so when you changed from that and you went into sustainable, and I understand there's it's called SIP, Sustainable in Practice Certification, what exactly are you putting on your soil?
We would be using synthetic products. For example, we would use Roundup, which has an environmental impact quotient of 15. So you see, that's much lower than many of the products we might be using when I was doing the organic.
Okay, well, let's go on to Marty Mesh and see. Marty, organic, can you just give it a quick summary of what you look for when you're certifying organic farming? Just quickly, what are the principles?
Well, organic farming and principles start out with attention to soil, to the health of the soils, and really minimizing. It's really minimizing off-farm inputs. It's trying to control and manage operations through management practices, and then using natural materials and management practices such as, you know, attracting beneficial insects. So farmscaping, you know, what can you plant to attract beneficial insects that might help with certain pest problems? And then if that doesn't work, or if there's a need to, there's a stair-step process that you would use a natural pest control product, could be an insecticidal soap or garlic spray or BT or whatever. And then there are indeed another level of allowed synthetics, and those might be a dormant oil spray, for instance, in fruit crops. But, you know, the first requirement is to start off with management. Can you figure out how to manage your operation in concert with the environment and not use any off-farm input in that case, and then how using the one of least toxic concern, essentially, at best, and trying to figure out your system. And then with soil health, too, it's recycling of nutrients. I mean, John might use synthetic fertilizer now, or, you know, he mentioned Roundup, you know, which is an herbicide that certainly isn't available to organic producers, but, you know, he could be using a synthetic fertilizer in organic production. He would probably be looking at cover crops or, you know, compost or even manure as a side dressing in a vineyard, something like that.
You know, that brings up the question of cost in raising these grapes. Is organic a lot more expensive because of the increased labor that you have to use and that sort of thing? And can you say how many dollars per bottle it might be adding?
Well, I couldn't say how many dollars per bottle, but I would think that the increased labor that we used when we were organic, for example, we would get out and be hand hoeing weeds in the vineyard, whereas now we can zip up and down and knock our weeds back with Roundup. Now, the good thing about using the Roundup is that we don't have to break open the soil. And when you break open your soil, you're reducing your soil structure. You're making your soil less habitable for all the wonderful things that are growing in your soil.
Do you get a lower yield per acre when you go organic as opposed to sustainable?
I don't think in grapes that would be the case.
Let me ask you, John, are you using Roundup or any kind of synthetic because it's easier and faster, you don't have to use it as often, or is it because it's better farming in a sustainable way?
I personally, from the research that I've done, believe that using things like Roundup is actually smarter and it's better for the environment.
Now, why do you say that?
Well, Roundup would allow you to do no-till farming. I mean, for many people, it works great.
Is it possible to say how toxic Roundup is? I hear, it has kind of a reputation, maybe among people who don't know what it is, that as being kind of toxic.
I think that the efforts to try and say that Roundup is toxic have not proven themselves.
Well, what is this environmental impact quotient? How is that determined?
I'm not totally familiar with all what goes into it. And but it's what's available for me to try and judge what I'm putting in my field.
Let me ask Marty Mesh, how do we know that our food is truly organic? I mean, what happens if there's an organic farm next to a non-organic farm? There's wind, there's rain, there's pollen, maybe cross-contamination. How can we be sure that we're spending that extra money, effort to buy organic, that it is?
Well, to be sold on the shelves of the United States, it has to meet the standards of the National Organic Program. And the National Organic Program is a federal program. And as organic farmers, we went to Congress and asked to be regulated so that you know, there would be a uniform definition of organic in the marketplace, and hopefully consumers could have confidence in the label, and that the standards across the country and even internationally would be the same if the product is destined for sale in the United States. And so it's a public process, and citizens can participate in the proposed standard change, and the standards were really painfully long, but were made by conversations between environmentalists, organic farmers, you know, people involved in industries, and we came out with a definition that I think everybody agrees is probably one of the highest, if not the highest, organic standard in the world.
Well, Do you believe that organic products overall are healthier or more flavorful or better for you, or what?
Well, and you know, I'll answer that in a second, but I also wanted just to set the context of, you know, I choose not to try to pit farmers against farmers. And so, you know, John, for whatever reason he did, decided to operate his vineyard in a different manner than organic. I'm not here to, you know, we try to meet farmers where they are and encourage them to be more sustainable, in fact. And, you know, the word sustainable has been kind of co-opted on some levels by some people in industry, but I would also venture to say that organic farmers could use practices to make themselves more sustainable as well. And so I think all farms are on the path to looking at their own operation and figuring out how they can farm better as an individual operation.
This is so fascinating. We have hundreds more questions. We need to go to a break now. I'm sorry. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guests are John Hilliard from Hilliard Bruce Winemakers and Marty Mesh from Florida Organic Growers. We're discussing sustainable versus organic farming. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we're talking about sustainable versus organic farming. Here giving us the perspectives of sustainable is John Hilliard. He's the co-owner of Hilliard Bruce Winemakers in California, talking about how he takes care of his vines carefully. He uses certified sustainable principles. And Marty Mesh, executive director of Florida Organic Growers, giving us the certified organic perspective. And by the way, in conjunction with Earth Week, because Earth Day, of course, is April 22nd, there is a Sustainopia conference here in Miami. It brings politicians, scientists, celebrities from all over the world to Miami Beach Botanical Garden to discuss sustainable topics. That's today and tomorrow, but Saturday, there are family-friendly activities throughout the day, and Easter Sunday, from 1 p.m. to sundown, there's music and bring your own picnic. That's admission free, and it's all about sustainable week. So that's at Miami Beach Gardens, a botanical garden. That's mbgarden.org for more information. So now we're going to dinner in minutes. And let's not leave out the fact that it's Easter coming up this weekend. And this is a quick and easy dinner, perfect for Easter or for any time. It's herb-crusted lamb steak with wild mushroom rice piaf. Now, lamb steak is a steak that's cut right through the leg of the lamb. It makes a round steak with a small bone in the center. It's about an inch thick. I love to use it. It's really simple and easy because you can saute it or broil it for just a few minutes per side. So for this one, I line a baking tray with foil. That's to make it easier to clean up. Broil the lamb for about 5 minutes. While that's cooking, I mix some garlic and breadcrumbs and dried sage together with a little mustard. Turn the lamb steak over, broil a few more minutes, add the breadcrumbs, another 2 minutes, and it's done. So that's like under 10 minutes, it's done. For the rice piaf, saute some wild mushrooms, some garlic, and rice for a couple of minutes. Add some chicken broth, simmer it, and cover it, and let's just let it be for 15 minutes. So it's really easy. The complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter, at L. Gassenheimer. Fred. Are we talking? Can I guess what we're talking about for wine? Fred, are you there? We've lost Fred. Well,
yeah, this is something completely different, I guess. But if you're on a serious social circuit, Easter is the proper time to buy a fancy hat and parade around in it. and hold the first major brunch of the season. The problem, though, is that brunches are difficult for wine fans because so many of the popular dishes contain eggs, poached eggs Benedict, casseroles, souffles. And eggs are a problem for wine. They tend to coat the palate and prevent you from tasting the wine, and that's what you really want to do. So one solution is the mimosa, bubbly with orange juice.
It goes very nicely
with these egg
dishes. Didn't we think so, Bonnie?
Absolutely. Fred, bubbly.
Bubbly, absolutely. Vegan bubbly, if I can do it, too. This is very festive as well. But now, you might think that it's easy to make a mimosa, but it really isn't. And since Linda is a graduate of Le Cordon Bleu, I looked up how that famous culinary institution makes a mimosa, and boy, was I impressed. For starters, I'm happy to say that Le Cordon Bleu keenly approves of the mimosa. It praises the way that, and I quote from their website, brought a calm smile to those who try the soft and gentle blend of orange juice and champagne, just waxing lyrical about it. And it has rules for making a mimosa, and I guess this would be a perfect one because there are a lot of rules. First, the perfect ratio for a mimosa is 3 parts champagne to 1 part orange juice. Nothing else will do. Second, you must use freshly squeezed orange juice, and the website says preferably using oranges plucked directly from the tree, which is easy for you to say in Miami, but in Michigan it's a little more difficult. Third, if you have to purchase the oranges from your greengrocer, you have to insist on medium-sized, firm navel oranges that are evenly formed, and they must be deeply colored. Fifth, you squeeze the juice yourself, and you time the squeezing so you can chill it for no more than a few hours before serving it, because otherwise it might get bitter. Number six, if you insist on cutting corners and buying packaged juice, you have to select the not from concentrate. Number seven, if you have to use concentrate, which tends to be bitter, you might consider adulterating the mimosa with a touch of grenadine, which is a syrup made from pomegranates, to sweeten it. But what's really odd here is that after all this about the orange juice, Cordon Bleu says nothing about the champagne, nothing at all. My own advice, of which I'm sure Cordon Bleu would strongly disapprove, is not to bother using expensive champagne because its aroma and body and flavor will be utterly altered by the juice. So a $20 California sparkling wine or even a $10 Spanish cava will do well. So I don't know, shoot me.
Okay, we're not going to shoot you. Thank you very much for that extensive discussion on how to make a good mimosa.
Now, Linda, you're a Cordon Bleu graduate. Do you make it that way?
I wouldn't adulterate my very good champagne. You know that.
Oh, good.
Adulterate.
Never mind. No, Fred, I haven't made a mimosa. Thank you very much. Okay. But I want to get back to sustainable versus organic.
Yeah, and interesting stuff.
Right. And here's a question that I have that a lot of people have mentioned this to me. You know, we have the Costcos and the Walmarts and the supermarkets all selling organic produce. Now, I don't think we grow that much organic produce in the United States, so it must be coming in from outside the state. So how is it being regulated, and what are we as consumers to think about this?
I assume that's a question for me, and the answer is that if it's sold as certified organic produce within the United States, it has to meet the USDA National Organic Program standard, whether it's in Oregon or Florida or Hawaii or Mexico or New York. And so anywhere in the world, if it's labeled as certified organic on the shelves of the United States, it's been inspected, audited by an accredited certification program, an ISO-compliant certification program to meet the USDA requirements. I did want to comment on somebody that asked about health stuff, and I serve on something called the Organic Center. If you go search the Organic Center, that's a research center for organic, and there's studies, there are more and more studies that show the environmental benefits, the health benefits of organic on that website.
Okay, well, that sounds wonderful, and I wish we had much, much more time, and I want to thank everybody who's called in that we didn't get to them. It's been really fascinating. We could do a whole week's worth. John Hilliard, thank you so much. It's Hilliard Bruce Wines and Marty Mess, Executive Director of the Florida Organic Growers. Thank you for joining us. Next week, it's Evan Benn with the new food editor for the Miami Herald. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for joining us on Topical Currents. Our producer's Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at WLRN.org. Join Ed Bell with another edition of South Florida Arts Beat tomorrow, and we'll return Monday with psychologist John D. Mayer. Bonnie Berman wishing you a great day and weekend. Stay tuned for Here and Now from NPR News.